Today's scripture reading is from the Gospel of John. Early on the first day of the week, while it was still dark, Mary Magdalene went to the tomb and saw that the stone had been removed from the entrance. Now Mary stood outside the tomb crying. As she wept, she bent over to look into the tomb and saw two angels in white, seated where Jesus' body had been, one at the head and the other at the foot. They asked her, "Woman, why are you crying?" "They have taken my Lord away," she said, "and I don't know where they have put him." At this, she turned around and saw Jesus standing there, but she did not realize that it was Jesus. He asked her, "Woman, why are you crying? Who is it you are looking for?" Thinking he was the gardener, she said, "Sir, if you have carried him away, tell me where you have put him, and I will get him." Jesus said to her, "Mary." On the evening of that first day of the week, when the disciples were together with the doors locked for fear, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." After he said this, he showed him his hands and sighed. The disciples were overjoyed when they saw the Lord. Now Thomas was not with the disciples when Jesus came. So the other disciples told him, "We have seen the Lord." But he said to them, "Unless I see the nail marks in his hand, and put my fingers where the nails were, and put my hands into his side, I will not believe." A week later, his disciples were in the house again, and Thomas was with them. Though the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." Then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here, see my hands? Reach out your hand and put it into my side. Stop doubting and believe." Thomas said to him, "My Lord and my God."
We've been in the Gospel of John, chapter 18 and chapter 19, the last couple weeks, looking at the arrest and the crucifixion and the burial of Jesus. So we're staying in John this morning, John chapter 20, for the resurrection. And as you just heard read, there are two characters in particular that come to the foreground in John's account of Easter Sunday. There's this woman named Mary, and there's this man named Thomas. So this Easter, I want to spend all our time just with these two individuals. And let me give you the thesis statement up front, and then we'll spend the rest of our time kind of unpacking it. The thesis, the big lesson we learn from Mary and from Thomas, the sermon in a sentence essentially, is everyone is a doubter until they're found by Jesus. Everyone is a doubter until they're found by Jesus. And I want to break that into two parts. So first, the everyone is a doubter part, and then second, the until they're found by Jesus part. We'll do one at a time. So first, everyone is a doubter. One of the most striking, almost comical things about the gospel accounts of the resurrection is the extent to which this seemed to take Jesus' inner circle completely by surprise. And the reason that's striking is because not only had Jesus said repeatedly through the Gospels before this happens that he was going to rise again, but he'd also said repeatedly when he was going to rise again. If you read the Gospels over and over again, he says, "On the third day, I'm going to rise again. They're going to kill me, but I'm going to rise again on the third day. Don't forget, it's going to happen on the third day." And then here we are in today's passage. We've arrived at the third day, and shockingly, no one is at the tomb. In John's account, it's Mary alone. Mary alone, this one woman who goes to the tomb on the morning of the third day, on Easter Sunday, which means they hadn't believed what Jesus said at all. They hadn't believed it even 1%, because if they had believed it even 1%, they would have been there at least out of curiosity to see if something might happen. But instead, they stay home, they're huddled up, they're grieving. They hadn't believed what he'd said at all. Mary goes alone. She goes only to grieve, kind of pay her last respects. And when she gets there on the morning of the third day, stone has been rolled away, the tomb is empty. Now remember, she's been there. She has been there. She's part of the inner circle. She's been there when Jesus has said over and over again, don't forget, on the third day, I'm going to rise again. She's part of that group, which means you would think that when she gets there on the morning of the third day, the stone is rolled away, the tomb is empty, you would think that she would at least scratch her head and say, huh, third day. What, didn't he say something about the third day? But no, what does she say instead? What does she say instead? Well, somebody must have stolen the body. And the reason that line is so beautiful, it lifts our hearts, at least it lifts mine, is because it proves that the people in the Gospels, the people in Bible times, were just as much the cynical, hardened realists that we are today. They're no different than we are. She gets there, it's empty, and her first thought is, well, somebody must have stolen the body. And, you know, there's this tendency among modern people to think that ancient people were kind of just, sort of stupid, you know, really gullible, and would just believe anything. You know, they didn't know any better, poor things. C.S. Lewis calls this chronological snobbery. And he says, you know, this belief that we just know better, we're smarter, we're more cynical, we're more critical, and we're not going to fall into all these silly things that people believed in the past. People back then were just kind of stupid. And if you make that assumption, like a lot of modern people do, then you're shocked to see the way that the earliest followers of Christ respond to Easter Sunday. Not like you'd think an ancient person would respond, but just like you or I would respond with cynicism, with disbelief, with doubt, with looking for a natural explanation, even when the evidence is pointing in the opposite direction. Everyone's a doubter. Everyone is a doubter. And, you know, if you think Mary's bad, just look at Thomas. Thomas is even worse, or better, I guess, if you're looking for encouragement, you know, somebody you can relate to. So Thomas, he's not there on Easter night when Jesus appears to the rest of the disciples that evening. We don't know why he's not there. It could be nothing. He could have just been, you know, out running an errand, or it could be kind of significant. It could mean that he had kind of already jumped ship. You know, he saw what happened and he deserted. You know, he didn't want to be associated with what everybody in town was already whispering about. You know, that failed movement with that failed leader, you know, that public execution, how disgraceful. I feel so bad for his followers. You know, maybe he's already trying to get away from that. We don't know. Either way, he's not there when Jesus appears to the rest of the disciples. So all he has is their testimony. You know, Thomas, we've seen him. He's alive. Jesus is alive. And Thomas's response, you know, he has every reason psychologically to want to believe them. You know, this would be the best news for him personally that he could receive. These are his best friends in the whole world. These are the people he trusts most. So if there was any way that he could believe this, he would. But instead of accepting their testimony, his response is, oh, great, you've seen him. That's great. Yeah, I know, I wasn't there. Yeah, it's too bad. Yeah, right. The only problem was I was there when they hammered those spikes through his hands into the wood of the cross. I was there when he was hanging up there for hours in agony, bleeding to death, suffocating to death, this ironic King of the Jews sign above his head, people hurling insults at him. I was there when his body went limp, and I was there when that soldier ran a spear through his side just to make sure he was really dead, really good and dead. I was there for all that. So you'll forgive me. You will forgive me if, until I see this so-called risen Christ, until I put my fingers into the wounds in his hands and put my hand into the wound in his side, I go on believing that you are all full of it. You'll forgive me for that. Everyone's a doubter. Everyone's a doubter when it comes to the resurrection. Nobody believes. Even Jesus' closest followers, even Mary when she sees an empty tomb, even Thomas when all of his closest friends are telling him this is what happens. They don't believe. Everyone's a doubter when it comes to the resurrection. And what that means is if you're a doubter, if you're here this morning as a doubter, as somebody who doubts either the historicity of the resurrection or the truth of Christianity or the reality of the supernatural or even the existence of God. If you are a doubter, what that means is that you are not as excluded as you thought you were. You know, Easter Sunday is a doubter's day, essentially. The heroes of the Easter story are doubters. And I think there's this tendency of doubters to think that your doubt kind of makes you a special, you know, breed, a non-religious breed of human being. There's a couple different ways you might feel about that, I guess. You might be disappointed, you know, like you there's things you appreciate about religion, there's things you like about it. Too bad that I doubt, you know, I'm disqualified, I'm kept on the outside. Or you might feel, alternatively, I think a lot of people in New York feel kind of relieved by their doubt. You know, they doubt, and it's kind of like that is an exemption from the whole religious thing. Oh, sorry, I can't. I'm a doubter. You know, I can't do that. It's like, having poor eyesight or something and being not eligible for the draft for the Vietnam War. You know, like, shucks, I can't do that. I'm a doubter. And it's very, very convenient for staying out of the whole religious thing and keeping your weekends free and all of that. So either way you feel about it, either, you know, kind of disappointed, I wish I could believe, I'm kind of envious of those who do believe, or proud and relieved, you know, I'm glad I have this doubt to be able to keep myself at a distance because I don't really want to join up with all that. Either way you feel about it, Mary and Thomas challenge you in that they say, look, being a doubter isn't even a special status to begin with. You know, you think you're special. You think you're different. You're not special. You're not different. Everyone's a doubter. Everyone's a doubter. Everyone who is a believer now, a true believer, was a doubter at some point. And just to really scare you, what the passage shows us is that those who start out with the most severe doubts often end up with the most sincere and deepest belief. Just, you know, throw that out there too. Everyone is a doubter. It's not a special status. It doesn't put you in a different non-religious category. That's the first point, first part of the message. Everyone's a doubter. Part two, point two, everyone's a doubter until they're found by Jesus. Until they're found by Jesus. And the key idea here, of course, is until they're found by Jesus. In other words, he's the one that does the finding. He's the one that reaches out. He's the one that helps a person, by his initiative, bridge this gap between doubt and belief. It's not that, you know, when somebody comes to belief, it's not that they went and found belief. It's that belief came and found them. We see this both with Mary and with Thomas. With Mary, it's especially instructive because Mary is this intensely passionate, tenacious, sincere person who, you know, if anybody was going to find Jesus on their own, it was going to be Mary. She surpasses all of her peers in that she doesn't believe, you know, she doesn't actually believe that Jesus is going to rise like he said he was, but at least she goes. At least she goes to the tomb. At least she wants to be close to him. At least she's pursuing her idea of him. And when she gets there and, you know, she can't, the body's gone, she can't access Jesus, she becomes frantic. She's really upset. She's crying. She's, you know, quizzing the angels who she doesn't realize are angels. You know, what happened? And then there's this guy who she thinks is the gardener, and she's ready to take him on. You know, what'd you do with the body? Tell me where you put the body. Where is he? I'll go get him. She's very passionate, very sincere in her pursuit of Jesus as she understands him. And the problem is she's looking for a Jesus that doesn't exist. She's looking for a Jesus that's still dead. And so she could look all day. She could do whatever she wants. She could yell and scream and flap her arms and whatever, and she's not going to find him because she's not looking for the real Jesus. And you look how different her perception of reality is from the way that the events are actually unfolding. So she thinks she is in the worst disaster of her entire life. There are two angels sitting right in front of her. There's the Lord Jesus Christ himself breathing down her neck. And she thinks she is totally alone, totally abandoned, totally forgotten. She's about to become one of the most famous people in the history of the world. She's blind. She is completely blind. She's sincere. She's passionate. She's smart. She's pursuing the truth. But she just is missing it. She's totally missing it because she's spiritually blind. And just like we are the same as Mary in our doubts, we're obviously the same as Mary in this regard too. We're spiritually blind. And I think people are frustrated by, you know, their sporadic attempts to connect with God. You know, they'll try every once in a while, try to pray or try to do this or try to do that, and kind of doesn't connect. It doesn't happen the way they think it's going to happen. And so they conclude, because this God of their imagination doesn't exist, therefore no God exists, which is pretty faulty logic. The reason that our attempts to God so often end in futility is because we're looking for our idea of God, an idea of God that's largely false, just like Mary's idea of Jesus was largely false. Jesus wasn't dead. She was looking for Jesus that doesn't exist. And if you look for a God that doesn't exist, you're not going to find it. When people say to me, you know, well, I don't believe in God, my first thought is always, well, tell me about the God you don't believe in, because I probably don't believe in him either. There's a lot of ideas about God out there that aren't true, and it'll lead you to a dead end. And if you're going to get past that, if you're going to actually connect with the real God, what that means is God has to be the one that reaches out. God has to be the one that breaks through, or else you don't have a chance. Fortunately, that's what happens with Mary. She's looking for Jesus, can't find him. And if Jesus just sat back and waited, he would have waited all day. But instead, he graciously steps in and approaches her. Woman, why are you crying? Who are you looking for? This is chapter 20 in the book of John now. So there's a lot of John that's happened before this. And if you've read from the beginning, you know that this is a pretty significant question. We've seen it a couple of times already. In John chapter 1, Jesus asks the first disciples who are kind of trailing behind him. He turns around and says, who are you looking for? What are you looking for? Throughout the Gospel of John, when he's healing somebody or when somebody's asking something from him, he often will ask a very similar question. What is it that you want? What is it that you're looking for? And a couple weeks ago, we saw this exact same question in John chapter 18 when we looked at the arrest. And the soldiers come into the garden, and Jesus steps forward, and his first words are, who are you looking for? And every time he uses it, there's a double meaning. There's the surface meaning of, you know, can I help you? What do you need? And then there's the deeper meaning, the deeper spiritual question that's being asked to penetrate the person's heart, which is, you know, who are you looking for? What are you looking for? What is it that you really want? Do you even know? You're lacking. You know you don't have something that you're supposed to have, that you want to have, but do you have any idea what it is? And do you have any idea that when you're looking at me, you're looking at the answer to all your problems, but you don't have the eyes to see it? It has that same double meaning here when he's talking to Mary, woman, why are you crying? Who are you looking for? You know, just the surface meaning of, you know, woman, what's wrong? Who are you looking for? And then the deeper meaning of, well, why are you crying? Why didn't you believe what I said? And who are you looking for? A dead Jesus? Really? Mary. So he asks her that, and, you know, she doesn't pick up on the double meaning. People rarely do in the Gospels because they're so locked into their own agenda and their own way of seeing things. So she's just kind of got her blinders on and says through clenched teeth and anger and fear and tears, sir, if you've taken the body, just tell me where you put it so I can go and retrieve it. And he pauses for a second and just looks her in the eyes and says, Mary. And I must have read it 20 times this week and been moved every time. One of the most poignant lines in all of Scripture, because it's all he has to say. It's all he has to say is her name. He just has to call her name and the blinders fall off. She sees, her doubt vanishes, and she believes. And she could have called his name all day. She could have asked after him all day long. Where's Jesus? Have you seen Jesus' body? I'm looking for Jesus, and not found anything until he called after her, Mary. It's the same with Thomas. Same sort of situation where he's locked into his own preconceived way of how it's going to go and what's happened. And you see the same tenacity on his part too, you know, and the same passion where he responds so angrily to the disciples despite their testimony. And his passion, his sincerity, his desire to find the truth is never going to get him there. Jesus has to come to him. So it's the a week later, exact same scene. This first time he appeared to the disciples was on Easter night. This is the next Sunday night, exactly a week later. And it plays out the exact same way. The scene is identical, actually, except for Thomas is there now. So if you take the view that he just happened to be out last time, then that's really not a big deal. He just happens to be in this time. If you take the view that he had deserted last time, already deserted, then this is pretty significant that he's now back. He's hanging around trying to see if there's anything to this. So same exact scene. They're in the room. The door is locked. And just as it had happened the week before, Jesus appears in the middle of the room, says, peace be with you, which is just, you know, shalom, a normal greeting. Hey. And, you know, just like last week, all their hearts are racing. Thomas's heart is racing quite a bit faster, not only because this is the first time for him, he didn't see him before, but also because of what he said. And he's got to be thinking at this point, okay, just play it cool. Maybe he didn't notice that I wasn't here last time. You know, just blend in, and we'll see what happens. And it's right then, right as he's thinking that, that Jesus turns and looks at him, and before he does or says anything else, walks right over to Thomas and goes like this. And he says, Thomas, I heard that you said something about the wounds in my hands. Go ahead. And Thomas is, you know, trembling and reaches out and puts his fingers in the nail wounds. And now he's got to be thinking, I just hope he didn't hear what I said about his side. You know, and it's right then that Jesus says, and my side too, right? And he pulls up his tunic. He says, go ahead, put your hand here. It doesn't hurt. So Thomas reaches out, puts his hand there. And, you know, at this point, completely loses it, you know, falls on the ground at Jesus' feet, sobbing, choking out the words, my Lord and my God. Everyone's a doubter until they're found by Jesus. Everyone is a doubter until they are found by Jesus, until Jesus comes to them. And, you know, the mercy, the sheer mercy of Christ in this scene is staggering. This is God. This is God himself. Thomas is a human being like you and me. He had no right to make that demand. He probably regretted it as soon as the words were out of his mouth to say something that disrespectful. He had no right. And instead, if it had been any other God, if it had been any other Savior, Thomas's days as a disciple would have been over as soon as he said that. You doubted me. You deserted me. We're through. But instead, Jesus comes to him. Jesus finds him. Jesus finds him. And gives him exactly what he had asked for. He says, stop doubting and believe. And the way that it happened for Mary and the way that it happened for Thomas is the way that it's happened for everyone who truly believes since. And it's the way that it would have to happen for you if you were to come to believe. You say, well, how is that? I mean, I guess I kind of follow you, you know, so far as the thesis is concerned and the stories. You know, I get how they doubted until Jesus, you know, found them, came and met them. I get that. I don't see how that is in any way transferable to today or me or anyone I know. Because, look, even if you think this really happened, even if you think it's all real, it's a long time ago. Even if you think Jesus did rise from the dead on Easter Sunday, he's not here now. So if your whole system, if the idea is that everyone doubts until Jesus comes and visits them, that's going to be a problem, because obviously he doesn't do that sort of thing anymore. But of course he does. Of course he does that sort of thing now. And he doesn't do it in the flesh, but there's a couple of different ways he still does it. So the rarer, more supernatural way is that he can come and kind of just appear to a person. This happens with the Apostle Paul, of course, most famously. He's on the road to Damascus. Paul is the consummate doubter, persecutor of Christians, dedicated his life up to that point to jailing and killing people who believed in the resurrection of Christ. And he's on the road to Damascus, and Jesus comes in a blinding vision, calls him by name, just like he did to Mary, shows himself to him just like he did to Thomas, and Paul's doubt vanishes. You know, he's not a doubter anymore. He's a believer. So that happens. It's Jesus is God. He can do whatever he wants. And it happens, I mean, more routinely than you might think. There's lots of stories to that effect throughout church history But it's not the usual way. It's not the normal way. So I, for instance, don't know anyone personally who's had that kind of experience. It's the number of people who experience Christ like that is relatively small. The more usual way, the more normal way, is that Jesus comes and finds you. Jesus comes and finds you through kind of more natural, so-called natural means. So through another person, through circumstances, or through events, or through scriptures, or through a church. And it's more natural, obviously. You know, you can explain it away. But the result is the same, you know, moving from doubt to belief. It's usually a more gradual process. It's not as instantaneous as meeting Jesus in the flesh or a supernatural blinding vision. But the end result is the same. And the end result is really just as miraculous. So, for example, my dad, my father, was a doubter up until his junior year of high school. He was kind of thought religion was annoying and, you know, didn't really have any use for it. Liked science, wanted to be an engineer. And one day after school, he's at home, and these kids that he doesn't know from his high school come and knock on his door, and he opens the door, and they say, "Would you like to know for sure whether you're going to heaven when you die?" And he said, "Nah," and slammed the door in their face. But he couldn't stop thinking about it. You know, he couldn't stop thinking about it. As much as he told himself that there was no such thing as heaven, as much as he reminded himself how obnoxious it was of those kids to go knocking on strangers' doors, as much as he thought about how infuriatingly cheery they were, he couldn't stop thinking about it. And so he starts noticing them more at school, you know, not without even really wanting to, starts kind of watching them. Finds out where they go to church, walks into their youth group service one day, and then comes back another time and another time. And slowly his, you know, his doubts, his questions start to just fade. And, you know, a lot of his questions are met with answers. The questions that he can't find answers for, all of a sudden they don't seem like they really matter that much anymore. And he believes. And the question is, how are you going to describe that? What happened there? What's the right way to describe that series of events? Did he find Jesus? No. Jesus found him. Jesus found him. It's the only way of talking about it that even makes sense. Jesus found him. And he moved from doubt to belief. Everyone's a doubter until Jesus finds them. So, as we close, just a word to two different groups. We said at the beginning, you know, there's if you are a doubter, there's two ways you might feel about it. You might be kind of disappointed, or you might be kind of relieved. Disappointed because it keeps you on the outside, or relieved because it keeps you on the outside. So a word to both of those groups. First, to those of you who are relieved by your doubter status, who like being a doubter, who would like to stay a doubter. What I'll say to you is just that that's fine. I get that, and I can respect that. But if he comes for you, it's kind of over. You know, and you can try to keep doubting. You can, but your heart's not going to be in it. And you see people do this. You see people do this. They try to keep doubting. They try to keep persisting in their doubt, even though the bottom has fallen out of their doubt because Jesus has come to them, and they just make themselves miserable. There's not a lot of point in that if it does happen for you. I'm not saying it will. I don't know whether it will or not, but that's just, in case it does, just a little bit of free advice. Take it or leave it. For those of you that are disappointed by your doubter status, who are somewhat envious of those who believe, who would almost like to believe yourself, but you just have too many doubts, a word to you, and this is the last thing I'll say. You know, the question is, can I do anything about it? Is there anything I can do? And I think there is. It has to be Jesus, ultimately. It has to be him that finds you. That's been the whole point. You can't go and find Jesus. You can't work your way into belief. That's not going to happen. But I still think there is are some things that you can do to speed things along if you'd like to. You can follow the example of Mary and of Thomas. So, like Thomas, if you've got these doubts, you can just vocalize them. You can just air them in all of their glorious offensiveness and arrogance. Just put it out there. You know, you've got it inside. Just say it and let it ring, you know, audibly. And challenge him, essentially. Challenge him. And if you do that, you know, I don't know. I don't know that he'll meet you. I don't know that he'll meet that challenge. But I would bet that he will. He may make you wait a while like he did with Thomas a week later. But I bet he will. And then you can also do as Mary did, which is just go looking for a dead Jesus. And what I mean by that is, you know, if you've got these doubts, just dive into them. Pursue them. Go. Mary goes and seeks. Her worldview is based on the fact that Jesus is dead, and she goes and lives that out. She goes and pursues it. So do the same. You know, try to get to the bottom of these doubts. Research them. Back them up. Try to support them. Don't let them just be hunches, just suspicions. Try to prove it. If you think Christianity is all kind of just this perverse distortion, if you think that Jesus is still dead in a grave somewhere, then try. Try your hardest to flesh that out and prove that to yourself. Go looking for a dead Jesus, and you might be surprised, like Mary, who meets you along the way at the tomb. Let's pray. Father, on this day, more than any other, our hearts are brimming with gratitude and joy and awe at the expansiveness of your love and the strength of your power and your tenderness and the way that you pursue us. Like Thomas, we fall at Christ's feet this morning and proclaim, "My Lord and my God." And Jesus, it's hard for me to believe that I have this right, but I know that you've told me that I do, that I have the right to ask you for anything, to approach you and ask things of you. And so I ask this morning that you would come and find those who are ready to be found. You come and take their hand. You come and grab onto them, and that they would know it's you. With our heads still bowed, I want to pray a prayer now that if this kind of applies to you, or if these words are something that you'd want to say, just repeat these silently in your own heart to God. Jesus, I don't know why, I can't explain it, but I feel drawn to you, and I almost want to say I believe in you, even though I have so many doubts and even though I have so many questions. I pray that you would help me with my doubts. I pray that if this really is you pulling on me, that you would confirm that in ways that are hard to explain away. I confess that I am not fulfilled and satisfied living a life without God. And if it's you that's put that dissatisfaction in my heart, I pray that you would bring me home. Amen.